Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
So, Mark Ellen, I have a Stankwaddy game. Are you ready?
I'm ready. Bring it on.
You have no doubt noticed the fashion in the world of hip-hop for naming solo acts as if they are small children with the kind of precursor little or lil. Yes,
little
or
young.
Okay, these are all lils.
Lil, okay.
So what's going to follow is a load of hip-hop performers who call Lil something or other, yes?
Yep.
But one of them is not a hip-hop performer, okay? And you've just got to spot the one that's a ringer.
Okay, right? But they're real, but they're not in that idiom.
Okay, so one is real, but not in that idiom. Right, okay, here we go.
Yep.
Lil Baby.
Yep.
Little Pump, Little Plum, Little Dicky, Little Peep, and Little Flip. Little Baby, Little Pump, Little Plum, Little Dicky, Little Pimp, Little Peep, sorry, Little Flip.
That's brilliant. Pump, I think, is a hip-hop performer. I just feel these are the right names, right? Dicky, also. Peep seems to be a kind of Peeps type thing, isn't it? Flip is also slightly hip-hop. Baby too. I mean, my only memory of Lil Plum as a Beano reader back in the day was there was an Indian squaw.
You're correct. It's not a squaw. It was a little boy.
The little boy. He had a little headband with a single feather at the back. Is that the guy? He was, wasn't he? Fringed jacket.
Here we go. Lil Baby is actually Dominique Armani Jones, born 1994. Lil Pump is Gazzy Garcia, born 2000. Lil Dicky is David Andrew Bird, born in 1988. Lil Peep is Gustav Swedish, who's born in 1996. Lil Flip is Wesley Eric Weston, born 1981. But Lil Plum...
Was it the Beano or the Dandy? It was the Beano, wasn't it?
It was in the Beano. It was his invention of Leo Baxendale.
And he used to say heap good, this, that, and the other.
There you go. Yeah. There you go. And you know what his full name was?
Go on.
His full name was Little Plum Stealing Varmint.
No. Try that now. Varmint.
You did well there. You did well.
That's fantastic. I've just been sent a Stankwaddy actually from one of our listeners, Nick Foreman.
Oh, very good.
July Farrow, it's a fairly straightforward spot the odd one out number.
Right.
Okay. And he says, all but one of the following have appeared in Radio 4's The Archers.
Oh.
You've got to spot the one that now, as you're a major Archers.
Well, I've stopped listening to The Archers.
This won't affect me. Anyway, back in the day, actually. Right, okay, so one of these six, seven names. One of these didn't appear on The Archers. Okay, Chris Moyles, Pet Shop Boys, Toya, Steve Lamacq, Morrissey, Terry Wogan, and John Peel.
Well, John Peel will definitely have been on it because he was a big fan.
Huge fan. He was on it, yeah.
And Terry Wogan will have been on it.
Yeah, he was too.
Pet Shop Boys will have been on it.
The Pet Shop Boys were on it, because I can remember this really well. It was in 2014, and there was a big thing about the Lox Fest Festival. Do you remember there was a festival?
Right, yes.
And there was some big issue about the noise and how it's going to affect the community. And I think the village landlady, was it Jolene and her band, the Midnight Walkers?
Oh, that's right.
Midnight Walkers, very funny. So, yeah, so they definitely were on and really, really loved it. Go on. So we've got you've got a few to go.
Was Morrissey on it? Gosh. I mean, he could have been. I'm going to guess that Morrissey was on it. Was he on it?
No, he wasn't.
Morrissey's
the ringer. He was approached by them. Some storyline, and declared himself to be intrigued and delighted, but nothing ever happened. So, he was the only one that was, but Steve Lamacq was on. I can't remember what capacity now, but he was.
That's amazing.
I can't remember. I think maybe somebody had a band and they were sending a tape off to somebody. I can't remember.
Yeah.
Chris Moore was probably the same sort of thing. And Toya, definitely. I can remember Toya being on. So that's very good. Yeah, well, Nick Foreman, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Nick. Anybody, please
send them in, because they're always very welcome.
Send them in. While we're clearing up business from last week, we were talking about the Enemy Encyclopedia of Rock and the enormous part it played in people's lives. And there was one piece of feedback I got that I don't think I read out. Lindsay Moss says, "My entire music education as a child came from the Enemy Encyclopedia of Rock. Never forgot my dad casually name-dropping Wet Willie. And me insisting he was making it up before running through to consult the book, which he knew I would do."
That's brilliant.
That's fantastic, isn't it?
Terrible name for a band.
Absolutely. But still providing humour many years later.
And didn't you get back to Nick Logan, who was one of the editors, wasn't you, and tell him? And he was very touched, wasn't he?
Nick was very touched.
Yeah, Nick has no idea that people still collect it and love it and are fond of it, and, you know, it was a big part of their lives, which it was, you know, and so I think he was rather...
It must have sold a lot of copies.
Yeah.
At the time.
Well, the fact they kept reprinting it and updating it so indicates that that people collected it, didn't they? It was really good.
The Word Podcast. Prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
So this week saw the sad passing of Wilco Johnson at the age of, 75 was he?
75.
Which, to be fair, was a lot later than it was expected.
Oh, God, no. I mean, he was originally thought that, you know, 7 years ago, wasn't it, that he had that operation where he had that terrible cancer and... you know, did a farewell tour, if I remember right. He made a kind of farewell album.
Oh, well, we'll talk about that in a second. But you know, this he certainly had an extraordinary last lap, didn't he? But an extraordinary life and career, really. I mean, genuinely unique person, wasn't he?
God, completely. There were two. I mean, it's also nice that in his lifetime, he would have seen both the Julian Temple films, which I'm sure you've seen, Oil City Confidential, which came out, I think, about 2010. I can't remember, which is basically all about, you know, Canvey Island and Dr. Feelgood. And then later, the one after his illness called The Ecstasy of Wilco Johnson. But I was amazed by things I just didn't know about him in those early things. You know, he was at college, wasn't he, studying... Anglo-Saxon and ancient Icelandic sagas. You're at Newcastle on Tyne University doing English language and literature. And, you know, there's bits in this interview with Julia Temple where he quotes Piers Plowman.
Yeah.
Now, there aren't many people who can do it. There's a lovely bit where he says, he's talking about what he does when he's got some free time. He said, well, the other day he said, I read Paradise Lost.
He said, wow, best of luck.
It took pretty much all day. I mean, it's about an 8-hour stint. He said, with a break for lunch. That's fantastic. So again, there aren't that many people. And when you saw him on stage, you probably wouldn't imagine this.
No, absolutely. Because, I mean, don't forget, when he went to university in those, you know, so he's born in, 1947 or something like that. You know, when the days when he went to university, there weren't that many people, certainly from a working class background, who went to university.
That's right.
It was relatively low percentage in those days. Yeah. It wasn't going to uni.
Yeah.
There was clearly something about him, you know.
Very bright. There's an amazing bit in the thing where he's must have been, I suppose, maybe early 70s, got very long hair.
Yeah.
And he's in the audience for Question Time. Have you ever seen that clip?
Oh, really? Is he?
Oh, yeah. It's fantastic. And they're talking about, and he harangues the politicians on stage for allowing the oil companies to ruin his beloved Canvey Island. And there's lots about Canvey Island in the film, too, just how much it meant to him as a place, you know, the whole kind of fiction that he invented, the whole kind of romance of kind of the Essex Delta, like the Mississippi Delta. And he was the Robert Johnson character. And Wilco Johnson was kind of Robert Johnson. It was just amazing. And he talked about the incredible light in the sky when it was lit up by the oil refineries. And also there's a bit about that, you know, that kind of character, the self-confident, self-contained, quite competitive character identity that people develop if they live on islands. And Canvey Island kind of was an island, wasn't it? I mean, it's not strictly speaking an island, but it kind of is, you know. It's
also the other thing to connect it with the America of the Deep South is the floods, you know.
Yeah,
the terrible Canvey Island floods that, you know.
Oh, yeah, he remembered that too. They were in about 1952-53, yeah. So he would have been about five, and there's pictures of people sitting on the roofs of their houses, and so all of that kind of affected the kind of folklore of the place. Really interesting. And then he had that period when he hitchhiked off to when people weren't doing that.
He did the hippie trail when nobody did.
He went to India when people just talked about it, and not many people did it. Absolutely incredible, really.
And then he was a teacher.
Yeah,
worked as a school teacher.
Yeah.
But you know, they got together with the other members of what became Dr. Feelgood. And I do think what's fascinating to me about Dr. Feelgood is that, you know, they were just like many bands that you would have found in little corners of England in the early 70s. You know, that there were, you can, if you see pictures of the early Dr. Feelgood, they just looked like the blokes I used to work in record shops with. You know what I mean? If you were being kind, you would describe them as unkempt. You know what I mean? None of them had ever thought about their appearance at all.
There was no grooming.
Cardigans, leather jackets, and there were hair coming out at all angles, like
a pork kind of pies, badly and, pints bad. In a dimple jug. Yeah,
absolutely, pints in a dimple jug. But something happened in Dr. Feelgood that I think is hugely instructive. And thinking about Dr. Feelgood, I thought to myself, this surely is the group that has most to teach all other groups that came afterwards, which is to work out what could make you unique.
Yeah.
And they suddenly worked it out, you know. And part of it was just their adoption of a different look. You know, because they used to look like the guys I knew. They just hung about the pub. And they suddenly just transformed themselves into kind of the guys that the guys I knew hung about in the pub would avoid. You know what I mean? They suddenly looked quite intimidating.
Yeah.
You know, with shorter hair and, you know, Lee Brello wearing the suit.
Very aggressive on stage.
And as Mick Farren famously said in the Enemy at the time, they looked as if they'd come together in some particularly unsavory region of the British Army. They did.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't look like the guys who hung about, like I knew, that hung about and listened to Little Feet records or whatever. I always got the feeling that at some stage in the musical development of Dr. Feelgood, somebody, could have been a member of the band, could have been a manager, could have been anybody, had kind of, so to speak, gone round the back of the band and suddenly just tightened up everything they did. So it's as if they'd gone round the back and found the hidden switch that enabled them to go. And then suddenly they were a totally different group. Do you know what I mean by that?
Yeah.
It's suddenly, absolutely everything's on edge. And suddenly every number you're playing is the last number you're ever going to play in your life.
Nervy, raw.
Absolutely.
Raw, unsettling.
There was nothing loose about them anymore, if there ever had been.
Yeah.
And I was, I remember going to see them. I went to see them on the last night of the Naughty Rhythms tour,
as
it was called. This would be 76, I suppose, something like that. 75, maybe. And they were playing at North London Poly. And they were... The lineup of the Naughty Rhythms Tour was Kokomo.
Yeah, I remember.
Chilli Willy and the Red Hot Peppers and Dolly Feelgood. And they were all really good in their different ways. You know, Kokomo were kind of... They were session players, really. You know, they were very practiced, very kind of smooth. Chilli Willy was sort of zany, Notting Hill version of the Flying Burrito Brothers, I suppose. And then there was Dr. Feelgood. And Dr. Feelgood took that stage, and you thought immediately to yourself, they've got that thing that great groups have got, which most great groups don't know they've got, which is internal drama. There's drama going on,
yeah,
absolutely all the time. And in the case of Dr. Feelgood, the drama was mainly between Wilco and Lee Brillo.
Yeah.
That there was, it seemed as if there was a fight was going to break out. Well, clearly it never was going to break out at all, but that was always the feeling. And then
you never got the feeling they loved each other. They weren't a kind of gang of brothers. It was really edgy, wasn't it?
Really edgy, tearing towards him and then going, you know, clockwork mouse reversing away.
Yeah.
And you couldn't take your eyes off them, and particularly you couldn't take your eyes off Wilco because he had those really staring eyes under that pudding bowl haircut, you know.
He would stare at members of the audience, and then he would raise the guitar up like a machine gun. Do you remember that?
Yeah, absolutely.
And kind of just appear to kind of mow down the front row.
And they were just extraordinary in the sense, I was thinking about this yesterday, that, you know, the contrast between those three groups, and like I say, they were all wonderful. But, you know, Kokomo and Chilli Willy played the music. And Dr. Feelgood, the music played them. You know what I mean? You know, it was completely in charge of them. Something else had taken over.
Yeah.
Dr. Feelgood. And, you know, a lot of the obituaries said when Wilco died, trailblazer of a punk and all that stuff. Well, all right, fair enough. But, you know, Dr. Feelgood were just huge for a very short period of time. And I've got out here their first three records here. So you've got Down by the Jetty, which, don't forget, came out on mono, which is a big story at the time, you know, because it seemed very unlikely anybody would ever make a mono record again. And then Malpractice, where they outposed in front of a gentleman's hairdressing salon. And then Stupidity, their live album, which is made at Sheffield City Hall, which went to number one. What do all those three long-playing records have in common, Mark Ellen? They were all made in the year 1975.
Yes, all that's right.
Can you believe?
Incredible.
Absolutely astonishing rate of progress. Because they were just, they were absolutely flavour of the month for, you know,
but
flavor
he did,
of the year.
But you've got to be, it didn't sound like anybody else, you know. We did a podcast with him, which we should trail actually at the end of this. I'll dig it out. I had a quick listen to the end of it yesterday. We did a podcast for Word. He came into the office. I asked him to bring a guitar and a little battery amp. And it's fantastic, actually. And also, he talks about being on stage at the Wembley
The Rock and Roll Festival, 1972.
And he was in the band that supported Heinz,
yeah,
who I think was painted up. I think he did say look like kind of Tutankhamun, gold paint. And he had to explain to him what Teddy Boys were. And he's on the same bill as, you know,
Chuck Berry, Jerry Lee Lewis. But also, he got his act, didn't he, from Wayne Kramer of the MC?
That's right. He did. Yeah, he talks about that.
Yeah.
But no, it was fantastic. And he talked about learning how to play the guitar. And, you know, he'd started off with, you know, idolizing Hank Williams. And then, of course, it was Johnny Kidd of the Pirates, you know. And then he demonstrates that way he plays, which is this brilliant kind of percussive, locomotive rhythm style with the little tweaks and the little frills that make it rhythm and lead, you know. And when he died, I thought it was interesting that so many people, Paul Weller, Graham Coxon, you know, Franz Ferdinand, you know, talked about how influential he was. Clem Burke, too. Clem Burke said that there was a party where I think it was them and Blondie and Ramones and Richard Hell and people. And somebody bought back a copy, I think it was in 1975, of one of those records, and they played Nothing Else All Evening. So my feeling about him is that although your Eric Claptons and your Jimi Hendrixes affected people in an enormous way in terms of the stylists who played a certain way within an idiom, I think he was responsible for starting the sound of whole movements, you know. Andy Gill of Gang of Four is another one he talked about.
Yeah, definitely.
He used to say that we listened to that and we just adopted that approach. So it was not just the way he played, but it was the kind of brittle, incendiary, aggressive style that a lot of those industrial kind of new wave acts use. I think he was fantastically influential.
Yeah, hugely. And then of course, he left Dr. Feelgood, didn't he? You know, when they were...
Well, he talked about that too, and that was really interesting because they couldn't... It was such a tragedy that they couldn't resolve it. You know, you look back at that now, and that's another lesson that groups ought to learn, you know, if they were managed right or whatever. You know, that when Radio 2 were doing, you know, when he died the other day and they kept playing songs like Milk and Alcohol and saying, remember the great...
And that wasn't thinking, him, was it?
I know, you're thinking, he wasn't on this record.
Yes. It's obviously on the Radio 2 computer.
It is, Doctor.
That's obviously what...
They just hit the thing, up it comes. He had left the band by that stage,
didn't he?
Which reminded you that actually he wasn't in the band for very long, really.
Yeah. But three big albums in a year.
Yeah. The band went on for ages with all sorts of other people. But he talked about how they just didn't get on in the end. And it was one of those kind of really classic things where he was taking lots of speed and they were all drinking and they were kind of different cultures, you know. And they kind of fell out a bit. And then suddenly he was sacked. You know, and in a kind of properly organized, grown-up, real modern world, that probably wouldn't have happened. Somebody would have mediated. Somebody would have said, let's just work this out. But he was thrown out and he was absolutely heartbroken. And it took him a really long time to get over it. I can remember Robert Wyatt telling me about being thrown out of the Soft Machine. He said it took him years to get over it. It was a real mortal wound, you know.
Do you know, it's really funny that this... We did in the last days of Word. We had a gig at the Lexington across the road where we had Wilco.
We did
Wilco with Dylan Howe and Norman Watroy.
Yeah, true.
Just fantastic. God, they were good.
They were brilliant.
And we used to set up these gigs at the Lexington. It's quite a high stage at the Lexington. And I was the DJ, so that meant that I was up in the bit to the side of the stage and above the band. You know?
Yeah.
And once I got up there, I couldn't move. You know, couldn't get in or out without crossing the stage. And so I was there for pretty much that whole thing with Wilco, and I was in a perfect position to see him on stage, which was just brilliant.
Delightful.
But more to the point, earlier in the day, when they'd done their kind of sound check and they were kind of hanging around, there was a dressing room, but it was a tiny dressing room. So they were out in the place itself. They're just sitting in a corner, and there was Wilco and there was Norman and Dylan, and then there were roadies and whatever, I don't know, hangers-on. And he did not stop talking.
No.
He just did not stop talking. And you thought to yourself, my God, the rest of the band must find this hard work.
Yeah.
Because clearly nobody's going to say, Wilco, just calm down, pipe down.
Yeah, because you're Wilco, you're in charge. No, I'm sure it was impossible to deal with, but it seems such a shame. And of course, he didn't see it coming either. Yeah. He had no idea that the other three had got sick to death of him. And he was heartbroken.
Well, he re-emerged, didn't he? I was playing this yesterday. He joined the Blockheads.
Yeah, he did.
You know, because when Chas Jankel left the Blockheads, you know, post New Boots and Pennies and Do It Yourself, he left. And oddly enough, Wilco joined the Blockheads.
Yeah.
Which you would have thought, with Ian Dury, they don't need anybody else to start a fight in an empty room, do they, really? and you know, I've been playing this record. It's actually quite good. It wasn't much of a hit. And he contributed, well, the tunes, because Dury wrote all the lyrics.
Yeah.
Superman's Big Sister, Superior Skin and Blister. And it's got a track called, of course, Fucking Ada. Because this is
I remember that.
And take your elbow out of the soup. You're sitting on the chicken, which which is just a fantastic record. I do recommend if anybody's got a copy of that Laughter. Yeah, Laughter by Enduring the Blockheads with Wilco Johnson on. Get it out and play it.
Oh, he's so good. No, we should run that podcast. And it's so emotional too. He talked about Irene, his wife, which is one of those great relationships they met when they were teenagers, you know. Yeah. Married for 40 years. She died actually of cancer in 2004, whatever. And he said he was completely heartbroken about that. And then he had this extraordinary thing where he got ill and was told interesting point about that. He said when he was ill, and he was diagnosed with this terminal cancer. And he said, weirdly, he said, I felt very, very kind of accelerated and very, very, very kind of optimistic.
I felt very accelerated. You Wilco got Johnson.
Yes, quite. Yeah. But you got very little time left. So you've got to do all these things. But he said, I kind of knew what my position was. Yeah. And he said, when I was told that after the operation that actually that I'd beaten the cancer and I had survived, he said, I was really disorientated. He said, because I kind of understood the idea that my life was going to be finite, and I'd come to accept that. It's a really interesting point, because, you know, you imagine that if somebody told you that news, you just throw your hat in the air. He said, actually, I was really, really shaken by it, because I'd kind of, it upset the whole rhythm of what my life was going to be, you know. Obviously, he was immensely grateful, and it was another 7 or 8 years.
That's really interesting. I think it's absolutely fascinating. I can't believe nobody's made a film about it or based on it. I mean, I know you say that, you know, Julian Templer's made the film about Wilco Johnson, but it's maybe you can never make it work as a fictional narrative, but it is just extraordinary to be told in your 60s, which is presumably what he was, that you know you're going to die soon.
And you have to adjust to that.
You have to adjust to that.
Yeah.
And you're then in a job which traditionally, you know, you start at the age of 18, never thinking it's going to last very long.
Yeah.
But oddly enough, it does. Sort of half-heartedly, it does. You know, and don't forget with Wilco Johnson, and this is one of the aspects of this that fascinated me most when it happened, is that Wilco Johnson had been kicking around for 20 years, nobody in the media having the slightest interest in him at all.
Yeah.
And then it's announced he's going to die. And suddenly they all come running with
the great Wilco. I've always loved him.
I've always loved him.
I have an onion in my pocket. But didn't the same thing happen to Johnny Cash? Am I imagining it? Johnny Cash was misdiagnosed.
Oh, really?
And I can't remember and told that he had, you know, that his life expectancy was pretty finite. And I think for quite a long time carried on believing that and making records, you know, facing his up to his own mortality, etc. And then discovered that it was re-diagnosed and it was all right. So
went on the Muppet Show
to celebrate.
Totally changed overnight. But Wilco is just, it's an absolutely amazing story, you know, because when you watched him, like I watched him, you will have watched him at that Word gig across the road.
Close up.
And God, he was fantastic. There was, you know, no allowance for the passing years whatsoever. It was just like seeing him at the age of about 24.
And played with no pick. It's a tiny technical point, but I just couldn't believe that he could flay the strings like that and not kind of lacerate his fingers. Yeah. His hands must have been just like leather, you know.
But at the same time, you've got an audience who are watching him in a different way, aren't they? Because they're thinking, this is our last chance.
Yeah, completely.
Yeah.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found. That project manager I could never seem to hire? And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story.
In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
That really makes a difference to a gig, you know. So for the last however many years of his life, he must have been playing in front of people who thought, this is our last chance. And that, you know, that makes a difference. But didn't he, when he was first diagnosed...
I feel that about so many groups now, though. Don't you feel that too? Every time I see Dylan or the Stones or whatever, I kind of think, well, I mean, is there a possibility I'll see them again? I might. I don't know. So there is that kind of slight edge to it.
And when he was diagnosed, or misdiagnosed or whatever, we're not accusing any medical people of getting it wrong here. You know, these things can happen. Didn't he sort of save all his money and collect together everything he got and say, I want to go to Japan? Because he'd always liked Japan.
Yes, he did.
So
right.
He went to Japan. I think he flew first class. You know?
Yeah.
And it ended up being the first of 5 visits to Japan that he took over the next year. So
the long goodbye.
Yes. Yeah. Let that happen to all of us. Wilco Johnson, ladies and gentlemen.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
So we find ourselves once again dealing with a hot subject in the news, which is Bob Dylan's book.
Ever piping hot.
It's the gift that keeps on giving, isn't it? You've been talking about this over the last couple of weeks. So this is, what's it called again, this book?
It's called The Philosophy of Modern Song.
Okay, and you have, to be fair, when you talked about it, it's Dylan choosing a load of, is it 70 different records or whatever that, you know, that happen to mean a lot to him or he wants to write about them. And we've in the past remarked about the fact that how extraordinary it is that only 4 of them are by women.
I know.
Is that the last thing we were talking about?
Yeah.
So it's somewhat unpredictable, this book. But the latest thing is there's been a controversy about the way it's been marketed. Over to you, Mark Ellen.
Well, that's right. His publisher, Simon & Schuster, offered a special deal that 900 copies of this book were being offered at $600 each. That's $600, Dave.
Can you say that again, Mark?
$600 each for the hand-signed autograph, the signature signed personally by Bob Dylan that would be inside. So they put those on offer, and of course they sold out immediately. And what happened then is that some guy tweeted his autograph and his book saying, hey, look, this is great. I've got a copy and it's signed and by the great man himself. Someone else posted their signature and said, that's weird because it's exactly the same as mine. And then someone else and someone else. And then somebody else posted a very, very slightly different one. And then there were also examples of ones that matched that. And there are 3 or 4 different formats of that signature that clearly have been duplicated.
I think there are more than 3 or 4.
Maybe more. There's only 3 or 4 that appeared on Twitter anyway. And there was a kind of uprising. And this was then put to the publishing company. The publishing company had to come back. I mean, in the most... embarrassing apology, actually. I mean, on a very high level. The managing director, the CEO of Simon & Schuster, a guy called Jonathan Karp, who had sent with each of those copies a letter from him vouching for the signature's authenticity, had to then publicly apologise that they were not hand-signed by Bob Dylan. They were the work of what is known as an auto pen. An auto pen is where somebody signs something and it can then be duplicated.
Yeah.
And it can be signed kind of in ink, so it looks like a genuine signature, but it's not physically signed by
Bob Dylan. So if you get a letter from the President of the United States,
exactly,
it very often comes from an auto-signing machine.
It is. Yeah, but it appears to be signed. But in that context, you would totally understand that that person's not sitting at a desk having bits of paper shoved under their nose all day. But with this, I mean, the understanding is certainly for $600, Dave, that you are getting Bob Dylan's autograph.
And also, can I just interrupt at this point? If the publisher, the managing director of the publisher, is sending you a letter, you know, guaranteeing its authenticity,
it's
kind of with the understanding that if you sell it on, you will get the price. You know what I mean? Because if you go into the market with a thing like that, you want a letter saying
exactly,
you
know, that's the confirmation. That's what guarantees its authenticity. So, I mean, it's absolutely staggering. So the big issue is really, where did they send these out knowing that they were auto-pen? I mean, we just don't know. But subsequently, there has been a statement from Dylan himself. In fact, I've got it here. Where are we? So Dylan says, to my fans and followers...
Can you do it? Can you do it in his voice?
Do you do my fans and followers? I've been made aware that this, I don't think I can do the whole thing. Well, there's some controversy about the signatures on some of my recent artwork. No, he says so my recent artwork prints and on the limited edition Philosophy of Modern Song. I've hand signed each and every art print over the years, because that was the other issue. It's the people who bought his art prints. You know, and he sold thousands of those, which are hand-signed by Bob Dylan, and those aren't cheap. You know, we're immediately thinking, well, if he used an auto pen on the book, did he use an auto pen on the thing I've got up my wall in a frame, you know? But he's saying, no, he didn't. He said, there's never been a problem. But he says, however, in 2019, I had a bad case of vertigo. Sounds like a Dylan song, a bad case of vertigo. And it continued into the pandemic years. It takes a crew of five working in close quarters with me to help enable those signing sessions. And we couldn't find a safe and workable way to complete what I needed to do while the virus was raging. So during the pandemic, it was impossible to sign anything and the vertigo didn't help. Extraordinary, isn't it? With contractual deadlines looming, the idea of using an auto pen, which is clearly not written by Bob Dylan, by the way, but from the way it's worded. But anyway, fair enough. You signed it off. With the contractual deadlines looming, the idea of using an auto pen was suggested to me, along with the assurance, and this is interesting, that this kind of thing is done, quotes, all the time, unquote, in the art and literary world.
Mm.
Now, don't you think that's interesting? Because all the people were thinking, well, if Bob Dylan signing his books by auto pen, and I bought a copy of so-and-so's book, Big Celebrity, was that also signed by auto pen? He is suggesting here that that is a standard procedure, isn't he? That's what he's saying.
Oh, well, I've never heard of it.
No. It's I think that's quite interesting. He said, using a machine, he says, was an error in judgment, and I want to rectify it immediately. I'm working with Simon & Schuster and my gallery partners to do just that. And my gallery partners, that's interesting. I'd only just noticed that. Gallery partners. So
this will not lie down, actually. Because you're selling something as autographed, and now that's called into question.
Well, that beyond really calling the question, they have admitted that it's not. And he's also saying that this is done all the time. I think it's a big story. I really do. So Simon & Schuster, I mean, it's really embarrassing for them, because clearly they must have known it was an auto pen, mustn't they? They must have done. And it's complicated because, I mean, just getting Bob Dylan to sign 900 copies in itself is a logistical nightmare. Normally people go to the books, as you're always saying. You go to where the books are, the printers or the warehouse or the publishing company, whatever, and you sign them. To take 900 books physically to the person who's going to get the pen out is quite a complicated thing.
Yeah.
So Simon & Schuster, it appears, put this out at $600 a time, knowing it wasn't his original autograph. That's an extraordinary story.
It's extraordinary. It will run and run. And meanwhile, if you'd like to guarantee that your Christmas present is autographed, but you can actually watch the author signing. If you'd like to come to Foyles in Charing Cross Road this coming Thursday, I will be there signing copies of my book about Abbey Road. And there will be no auto pen.
No involved. Auto pen in evidence.
This will be done entirely live and in the moment.
The Word Podcast. Clearly, there is no plan.
Well, it's the 40-year anniversary of Thriller, which came out, I know, on November the 30th, in 1982. And, of course, I interviewed Michael Jackson for Smash Hits, which was the second last interview he ever did in his life. He did a short phoner with the Daily Mirror just after that, and then never did another interview. I mean, mine was on the phone too, but it was pretty extraordinary, actually. And that was interesting. it's one of those things where you talk to him and you got the impression that that he was actually extremely savvy and extremely switched on and alert about the whole idea of A&R-ing the record, the material that was on it, the way it was produced, the whole recording process. He was incredibly lucid. The moment you went off that and talked about anything else, he drifted into this kind of, well, it's magic, you know, this kind of strange kind of fairy tale childhood thing. And he would go on about his phone friends at the time, who were Steven Spielberg, who'd become a pal of his because he was so obsessed with E.T. He had a private cinema in the house he lived in. This is before he moved to Neverland. There's some gigantic ranch anyway out in Los Angeles. He had a private cinema where he'd invite people over and watch E.T. over and over again on a loop because it's his favourite film. His other phone friend was Adam Ant. Oh, yeah. And Adam Ant, you forget Adam Ant was a huge star in 1982. And they were kind of, they felt themselves to be kind of pretty much equals. And he would talk to him all the time on the phone. And they'd talk about clothes. And they'd talk about... And Michael Jackson talked about fairy tales. He was happy when he was reading these fairy tales. He was reading when he was young. You know, very, very, very peculiar fellow. And but the of the many extraordinary things about it, 9 tracks on that record, and 7 of them were huge hit singles. Isn't that extraordinary?
Was it 9? I don't
there
know.
9. There was Wannabe Starting Something, Girl Is Mine, Thriller, Beat It, Billie Jean, Human Nature, and PYT. Those were the singles, I think.
Yes.
Post, there was A Lady in My Life and Baby Be Mine were the only other ones, and they weren't singles. But I mean,
Post-Thriller, in the American record business, they used to talk about their ambition for a record was, we think this one can go 6 deep.
So six deep,
which meant we can get 6 hit singles out of it.
Yeah.
Because that was the way. Because, you know, earlier on, we were talking about Dr. Feelgood, who made 3 LPs in 1975. The whole idea of making a record like Thriller was you didn't make another one for years.
Yeah.
Because you kept it going for years, you know. And it is looked at in a certain light, the most profoundly cynical long playing record ever made. You know, because when they gathered to make that album, Quincy Jones made a speech to Michael Jackson and Rod Temperton and Bruce Sweeney and the engineer who was there and whoever else was there. He said, "We are here." It was like the opening day of shooting of a Hollywood movie. "We are here to save the music business." Because at the time, the music business was in the relative doldrums. You know?
Yeah.
You know, it had kind of peaked with Fleetwood Mac and Saturday Night Fever and so forth, and then it had dipped. And this is the dip just before video.
Yeah.
And, you know, so they made that record in the most, you know, savvy fashion possible, which is, we're going to make sure that we've got a cut that can be played on rock radio. We're going to make sure we've got something that can be played on middle of the road, daytime radio. We're going to have one dance hit. We're going to have something that appeals to the
crossover with Paul McCartney, wasn't there?
Absolutely.
Every single thing was mapped out.
Absolutely. Everything was mapped out. It took them absolutely ages to do it. And when they did the first cut, they'd warned Michael Jackson that he was trying to get too much signal on it, and that if you get that many songs, you're trying to put that many songs on the tracks towards the end of the LP. Don't forget, this is in the days of the LP. It's the last days of the LP. You know, your signal on the last track on each side will be really squashed.
Yeah.
So he was really disappointed with it, burst into tears, in fact. And they went away and pretty much did it again. And what are the tracks that they added in the second version? Beat It and Billie Jean.
Unbelievable.
Just absolutely amazing. And it's amazing. You talk to people in the music business and they'll say how often it is that that happens. How often it is that that stuff comes along later, where people are either desperate or they're loose or whatever, or they haven't thought about it too much.
What a different entity it would have been without those.
Totally incredible.
And that also, the Beat It, I remember when Eddie Van Halen died, and we talked about that at great length, and that was another extraordinary story.
Yeah.
That he knew nothing about them. He said he remembered some Jacksons. I think he remembered the Jacksons ABC. He didn't really know anything about Michael Jackson at all. came on and supposedly recorded that in two takes, and they used the first take or whatever. I mean, it's just, and you think what a difference that made to the song. It's fantastic, really.
Because the previous record, Off the Wall, which, you know,
when did that come out? 78, 79, I'm not sure.
Which was obviously a kind of slow build record. There was, you know, when that appeared, there was no great expectation that it was going to be huge. But it had been quite a while, you know, it was a few years before Thriller came back. And I remember, I think I'm right in saying this, that CBS had a little playback party for Thriller in their office in Soho. And I think pretty much the only person to go was Neil Tennant. I think I'm right in saying that.
Yes, I remember that.
Yeah, I think it was.
Why didn't we go? That's incredible. Well,
because Jacko wasn't going to be there, and nobody wants to be in a room listening to a playback of anything.
No, you know, Neil was so interested in it. Yeah.
Well, Neil was really interested, which fair enough, you know.
Yeah.
And but you know that, you know, but Quincy Jones said this is the record that will save the record business, and of course he was right, you know, because he'd also coincided with the arrival of MTV in the United States, and the arrival of the CD.
Yeah.
So people bought it twice.
You know? And we never put it on the cover of Smash Hits. Isn't that astonishing? You know, there we were with the only interview. But then we weren't to know at the time. You know, I just had a pre-release cassette. I remember him getting very wound up about the fact. I said, well, I've got a copy of it. It's out. It's in the stores. He got really, really concerned. I said, can I tell him, relax? Everything's fine. I've got an advanced cassette.
Have you still got the cassette?
I wish I still had. God, that'd be worth some money.
You probably recorded a Toyer interview over
I probably did. Yeah, I've got Gary Neiman on one side. And that's right. Les Neiman of Haircut 100 on the other. I know.
The Word Podcast. Fix yourself a drink and it's like being in the pub.
Welcome to another birthday slot. One of our birthday patrons. Very nice to see him again. Kevin Walsh, Kevin in New Jersey. Now, Kevin has a couple of questions items to chuckle to the fire.
Stroke chin.
Pensive fashion, philosophical fashion. And one was about tribute acts. What was your question about tribute acts?
So the question of tribute acts is near where I am. When I check the listings on local venues, it's close to half tribute acts at this point. And
that's,
you know,
right.
I thought about doing a Stackwaddy game where I named some real tribute acts and then I threw a false one in there. But I think you guys already did that at some point, so I didn't want to repeat things. But it occurred to me, like, you know, there. On the one hand, I have friends who go to these things and absolutely love them and get a lot out of them. Every time I've gone to them, I've felt sort of something missing. I don't know exactly how to describe that. I went to a Beatles one time, and it was guys, I swear to God, like my age and in my shape with Beatles wigs on and trying to fit into the suits that didn't quite work. And it was painful. You know, it was really painful. And I also saw a Tom Petty act one time that was actually a little bit better. They weren't trying to dress up quite as much, but we watched that, and it was, I guess, it was an enjoyable way to pass the time. Obviously, with Alex, you know, literally doing that as part of his job, it occurred to me, you know, is this healthy? Like, is this healthy for, is this the same as going to a bar and seeing a cover band, which I love to do too, you know, but it seems like the tribute acts are taking up more and more space.
But whether it's healthy or not, I mean, it's just obviously commercial, isn't it? Because a lot of those acts are acts that either you can't see, you know, the Smiths or the Jam or whoever, or they're the kind of acts who, when they do play the old stuff, they don't play it with a great deal of affection. And it may have changed from the version you remember. And so in terms of being guaranteed an experience of hearing those songs performed live with some accuracy, I can understand why it's a kind of safe bet. I mean, you know, the ABBA show is kind of like a tribute act, really. It's not actually ABBA, is it?
Well,
no, I don't know. I mean, that's just the way that things are commercially, aren't they? You're guaranteed of a certain type of experience, whereas going to see other groups is a liability. You spend all that money, and it could be they don't play the songs you want to play, or there's not the members of the group you thought were going to be in it, or whatever. And very few tribute acts can reform with the original lineup. The Damned recently reformed, didn't they, in Britain? And that was the original four, which is very rare, you know.
That's right.
Well, I think there's recently been the emergence of a kind of you know, kind of business class tribute act. You know, I think I've talked about on the podcast before, going to see this wonderful Dutch group called the Analogues, who do the Beatles records that they never performed live, and they do them just spookily brilliantly. Yeah. I think in the States, is it the Fab Four? New York session men, they do a very similar kind of thing. Yeah. And I think that's a wonderful, wonderful thing, actually. That's what I was thinking. The thing about the Beatles and the kind of tribute to the Beatles, it strikes me as a little bit like Gilbert and Sullivan. You know, Gilbert and Sullivan have been dead for 100 years or whatever it is. But still, people go out and troops of people perform the great, you know, operas of Gilbert and Sullivan in the manner that they were done in the 19th century. And that's the way people want them. And they probably, if anything, do them better now than they would have done them back then, you know. And I think that's probably what's going to happen with certain things. So I think it happens with the Beatles. It's obviously happened with Pink Floyd, and the Australian Pink Floyd are apparently very good. I've not seen them at all. But I think there's a lot to be said for the fact that nobody goes to see Pink Floyd to look at Pink Floyd. That's the beautiful thing.
Australia, if you're on stage at David Gilmour's birthday party.
That is a great point.
If you're on stage saying, "I'm Tom Petty," everybody in the audience is going, "No, you're not.
No, you're not.
You're clearly not." You know?
That thing is also, the Analogues don't try and look like the Beatles, and they don't even try to pastiche the Beatles. They just happen to sound extraordinarily like them.
Yeah.
So that's a different
thing. But also, at some stage, there are 10 musicians on the stage, as they have to be, in order to be able to replicate every note that was done on the heavily overdubbed record, you know.
Yeah.
And if you ever get the chance to see them, do go see them, because they are really remarkable.
Yeah.
So anyway,
Kevin, you had another point about you've been going back and revisiting old albums.
I have,
Some of them you thought stood up and still you could connect with, and some of them have been a disappointment. Give us an example of that. It's quite interesting.
I've been trying to do actually is going back to albums from bands that I love that I never caught on to. So it's almost like some of these bands aren't releasing music anymore, and like the Fountains of Wayne, for example, and you go back to their last album and it's excellent. It is still high quality.
Yeah.
You know, one of the ones that another podcast, I Am the Egg Pod, turned me on to the Paul McCartney Fireman. You call it a side project? I don't know what you would call it exactly. It's a project. And the last album on that in that run is called Electric Arguments. And it actually has vocals and songs, and it is fabulous. It is a great, great record that I'd never hear people talking about. And it is full of songs. It is sonically interesting. McCartney is in great voice at the time. And it's the thing that that people always talk about with McCartney, where they say, if only there was someone who could get him to unleash a little bit more of his avant-garde side in a comfortable way. And I feel like that's what Youth, who's the
guy. Yeah, that's what's happened. With him,
yeah, really did that with him really well. I wish they would do another one because, gosh, that last album, which is what I've been, one of the ones I've been listening to all year, is fantastic.
But also that side of McCartney isn't really appreciated. Nobody's looking for the experimental McCartney, really. Yeah. They're expecting to be producing here, there, and everywhere.
Except that, I mean, the Fireman, the one you just talked about, Kevin, how old is that?
I guess it's roughly probably like 95 or something like that. Yeah. 96.
Okay, so 30 years old.
Yeah.
And the beautiful thing about music of any kind is it catches you eventually. It just does, you know, because what matters with music is whether you're receptive to it. And you can't guarantee you're going to be on the wavelength at the point that a record's released. You won't be. You'll be thinking about something else. Your family or God knows what. Yeah. You know, the years later, suddenly something strikes you. You just get in a mood. And I found myself doing that with loads of music from ages ago, you know. So my view is, don't go chasing music. Wait for music to come and chase you. just be in when it comes calling. That's the trick, I think.
Well, what I've tried to do with this thing is I've tried to be intentional about it, which I I feel like so much of today's music listening experience, for me at least, is either going into Spotify and just listening randomly to whatever playlists they offer me, or listening on my MP3 music library kind of thing, in which case I'm almost always just shuffling the whole thing, you know? And so trying to be more targeted. It actually came up because I realized I'd never consciously listened through Sandinista. So a couple of years ago, I decided that every month I was going to listen to Sandinista just to get myself up to speed.
God, that's adopting the big one. Is that a double or a triple?
It's a triple, yeah. It should be double. It should be a single. Yeah.
Yes, it should be. God, that's going in the deep end.
Yeah, and then I listened to REM's last album, which I always, you know, I loved REM. They were my band, you know. They put out an album, Greatest Hits album, and said, the band you grew up with. And they literally were the band that I grew up with. But that last album just never connected with me. I listened to it 12 times, still didn't connect with me. So
interesting.
I don't know what that is, you know, but I also listened to the Counting Crows.
It may happen.
Yeah, that's a really good thing to be doing. That's brilliant.
Yeah.
You see, thank you so much.
I also believe there's certain records you're not supposed to be parted from. And so I've had a few records recently where I found, I thought, have I still got that record? And these are my records I bought in 1972 and have literally listened to once.
Yeah. Wow.
And it's still there. It's like, I'm still here. you haven't thrown me away. You know?
Yeah.
And it's a great pleasure when you find that.
And the weird thing is when you hear those things, how you can hear almost immediately what the next notes are going to be, or the next lyric, or the next track's going to be, because those things are embedded in the memory so clearly. It's extraordinary.
Yeah. That is very true. I would also say next year on my list for next year, thanks to David's compilation, is the Jesse Winchester album, which I really haven't spent. I've never listened to at all, but I'm going to put that on the rotation for 2023. So
very good.
Well, the first two Jesse Winchester albums are both absolutely wonderful.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.